My name is Ed Sanders, and I must first say thank you for inviting me here tonight, giving me an opportunity to do something I love to do, and that is speak about Richmond's Civil War battlefield sites. The topic that I'll be discussing this evening, the Peninsula Campaign with a special focus on the 7 days, is very appropriate now as we are in the 150th anniversary, or as many are saying, the sesquicentennial for the actions. The armies are now sitting, the Army of Potomac anyway, is now sitting right outside of Richmond with the Confederate Army in preparation for launching the counterattack to try and drive that Federal Army away. This particular topic, too, is something that is close to my heart because I feel that the 7 days and the Peninsula Campaign as a whole is often understudied and even underappreciated for the impact that it truly had on the American Civil War. And hopefully throughout the course of this evening, you'll find out why I think that this particular campaign played such a pivotal part. Now, of course, once the city of Richmond is made the capital of the Confederacy, it will become the target for federal forces. Of course, we know that the first on to Richmond drive ended a failure at Manassas. Shortly after that, President Abraham Lincoln would look to a new man to lead the Federal Army. He would replace General Irvin McDowell with a young officer by the name of George B. McClellan. Now, McClellan had had some success in the western part of Virginia. He was a West Point graduate. He had had success in most everything he had done up to that point and truly had a charisma about him. He came to Washington, D.C. He took control of the Army of the Potomac, and very quickly he began to make it an effective fighting force. However, he would need to come up with a plan to try to take Richmond. And to Lincoln's great dismay, it would take him some time before he would implement this plan. But finally, in the spring of 1862, McClellan does do just that. His plan is basically to take his army by ship to the tip of the Virginia Peninsula. Now, keep in mind, the Virginia Peninsula that we are talking about is that piece of ground between the York River and the James River. And what he wants to do is come at Richmond from the east using those rivers as his supply lines. Hopefully, he can get at Richmond and bypass the strong positions that he feels the Confederate Army has north of the city. He does this, begins this move in March of 1862, lands at the tip of the Virginia Peninsula. His army begins to assemble. He begins to push forward towards Yorktown, and there, under a Confederate commander by the name of John Bankhead Magruder, Prince John, as he was often referred to, Prince John will have a small Confederate force of maybe about 13,000 soldiers. But what he will do is he will put on one of his best performances. He is known as somewhat of a person who loved the theater and was very theatrical. And this is arguably going to be one of the best performances he will put on because he will be able to create the illusion that there are many more troops than there actually are there at Yorktown. General McClellan, believing this to be the fact, will decide he's going to have to lay siege. And what this will do is it will buy time for the Confederates to shift more troops down to that area. About a month, McClellan will spend down there setting up his heavy guns, preparing to open fire, to lay siege to Yorktown. But just before he's about to open up with this great barrage, the Confederate commander now in the area, General Joseph Johnston, is going to pull his army away. Immediately, McClellan begins to pursue after the Confederate army. Now, also, because of the fall of Yorktown, shortly after this, Norfolk would fall. And this, too, would be a blow to the Confederacy, because the Norfolk was the home port to a ship by the name of the CSS Virginia. And you see, the Virginia had been patrolling the mouth of the James River. She was guarding the door to Richmond. And the first threat to Richmond will not come from the Federal Army, but instead by the United States Navy. You see, once the Virginia is scuttled, and they pretty much had to destroy her because she was a deep water ship and there were many places where the James was simply too shallow, so they couldn't sail her up towards Richmond, and she couldn't sail out to sea to another Confederate port because her engines weren't that reliable. They just plain weren't that good. And so they destroyed their ship. The door to Richmond, the James, was now open, and immediately a fleet of five ships, including the famous ironclad Monitor, began to sail up the James with orders to shell the Confederate capital into submission. They would be able to bypass or neutralize the other Confederate fortifications along the James River till they made it to a point just 7 miles below the city. There they came up on a partially constructed fort known as Fort Drury by the Confederates, Fort Darling by the Federals, or sometimes just Drury's Bluff. There, the Confederates had managed to put up about 7 to 8 guns, and they had also been able to put obstructions in the river. And that was the key to the defenses, because a ship like the Monitor could take the punishment and simply sail by. You needed to physically block the channel. And there on May 15, 1862, after a four-hour-long action, the Federal fleet is turned away. The first shots fired in the defense of the Confederate capital of Richmond come from groups you hardly ever hear about. Confederate States sailors, Marines, heavy artillerymen, as well as infantry. Federal fleet is pushed back. The Navy's attempt to take Richmond has failed. Never again would they make another serious effort. But the Army of the Potomac, is still pushing towards Richmond. By the end of May, the Federal Army is sitting right outside the Confederate capital. They can hear the church bells ringing in the city. And you have to realize what a dark time this is for the Confederacy. Since that first victory at Manassas in July of 61, they have suffered numerous setbacks across the board. They've been defeated at places like Forts Henry and Donelson. They lost at Shiloh. Most recently, you had the fall of New Orleans. The largest city in the Confederacy is in federal hands. And now the largest, best-equipped Union Army is sitting right outside Richmond. When you thought it really couldn't get much worse for the South, it did. The Confederate Army outside of Richmond under General Joseph Johnston would attack the Federals at a place known as Seven Pines or Fair Oaks. And by the end of the fighting, the most significant thing that happens in that action right outside Richmond is the Confederate commander's wounded, General Joseph Johnston. And you have to realize he is one of the heroes of Manassas. He is the one that people are looking to deliver them from this threat, at least the citizens of Richmond are. And now he's gone. And who takes his place but President Jefferson Davis's military advisor, a man by the name of Robert E. Lee. And while he will become a great hero for the South, at this point, many people thought he wasn't the right man for the job. Newspapers referred to him as Granny Lee, the King of Spades, because of his assistance on building protective works outside the city of Richmond. But Lee did have a plan. He realized that as the Federal Army approached the Confederate capital, they would be cut in two by the Chickahominy River. If you have the map that I handed out to you, it was done by the Civil War Trust, and you can use it as a very good resource to kind of follow the actions that I am going to describe. However, I will mention to you, the first time I looked at it, I was quite confused. I looked at it and I couldn't understand why all those actions took place north of Richmond until I finally saw where the North Arrow was and I realized it pointed to the left. So if you keep that in mind, it helps and it's a very good map. But just make sure you keep that North Arrow in mind. The Chickahominy River would literally cut the Federal Army in two. And what Lee wanted to do is attack that part that was on the north side. He hoped to overwhelm it, crush it, destroy it, if at all possible, and then push on to a railroad, the Richmond and York River Railroad, which connected White House Landing on the Pamunkey River to the front lines of the Union Army. White House Landing was so important because White House was the Union supply base, and supplies would be absolutely critical. And that railroad would be absolutely critical for bringing up the heavy guns that McClellan needed. I tell you, think of it this way. The Union Army outside of Richmond goes up and down in numbers, but roughly is about 115,000 men. If it had been a city in 1860 at the last U.S. Census, it would have been the ninth largest city in the United States. So what you have is literally a moving city coming at the Confederate capital. A moving city that will require, at the minimum, about 700 tons of supplies every day. Food and fodder. Not even getting into the weapons and the blankets and the other thing. At a minimum, 700 tons of supplies every day to keep it in the field. So you can see why Lee realizes if I can threaten, or better yet, cut that supply line, it'll force the Federals to fall back to reopen that supply base, relieving the semi-siege of Richmond. But before he can do that, he needs information. And so he's going to call on his 29-year-old cavalry chief, a man by the name of James Jewell Brown Stewart, more often called Jeb, even though I believe at West Point his nickname was Beauty because of his lack of it. Now he was in charge of the Confederate cavalry for the army protecting Richmond. And now he was given the orders of a lifetime. He was asked to make a reconnaissance of the right flank of the Federal Army, that part of the Union Army on the north side. And you can imagine what he thought when he heard those orders. It seems that sometime during their conversation, he mentioned the possibility of riding around the Union Army. But Lee told him to be cautious, but he didn't forbid him from doing it. He went back, and he selected from his command the 1st Virginia Cavalry under General Fitzhugh Lee, the 9th Virginia Cavalry under General Rooney Lee, a lot of Lees in this, and then elements of the 4th Virginia Cavalry as well as the Jeff Davis Legion, about 1,200 troopers that he would select for this ride. And on the morning of May 12, 1862, he woke up his staff with the words, "Gentlemen, in 10 minutes, every man must be in the saddle." And now they began. Initially heading to the north and then to the west, hoping that maybe the Federals, any Federal spies who were out there, may think they were heading to join Jackson in the valley. But the very next morning, they turned not north, not west, but east towards the Union Army. They would head towards Hanover Courthouse. There they would come up on their 1st Federal troopers, which they quickly pushed away. They would continue on towards Enon Church, and there they would skirmish once again with the Federals, and this time capture some of the Federal cavalry, who happened to be members of the 5th U.S. Cavalry. And keep in mind, the 5th U.S. Cavalry before the war was the 2nd U.S. Cavalry, and that was Fitz Lee's old unit. And this is how one soldier described the meeting. "I could not refrain from laughter at the pleasure which Colonel Fitz seemed to take in inquiring after his old cronies. Was Brown alive? Where was Jones? And was Robinson sergeant still? Colonel Fitz never stopped until he found out everything. The prisoners laughed as they recognized him. It was difficult to believe that the Union prisoners and the dashing young colonel represent opposing armies mustered to slaughter each other." Stewart would eventually have the information he needed. The right flank was vulnerable to an attack. It was not anchored on a strong defensive position. But how does he get that information back? He's now behind the Federal lines. And you can make a case that he never planned on returning back the way he came, but he would argue that it was more practical to continue on. They would not be expecting it. And he would indeed encircle the entire Federal Army. And by the time he is done, he will bring Lee the information he needs, and he will suffer only one loss, killed, Captain Latney of the 9th Virginia Cavalry. Of course, the burial of Latney, which was done by William Washington, I believe, in 1864, will become one of the great prints of the Lost Cause and would be in many homes after the American Civil War in the South. He was that one casualty. Lee now has the information he needs. The right flank is vulnerable. So he will meet once again at the Dabbs House with some of his officers on June 23rd. By this point, General Stonewall Jackson, a small valley army, is already approaching Richmond. People didn't know this, but Lee already had the wheels in motion. He had pulled together probably those generals he felt were best suited for the offensive. General A.P. Hill, General Longstreet, General D.H. Hill, and then to everybody's surprise there in Richmond, General Stonewall Jackson would pull up. He had spent about 14 hours in the saddle riding ahead of his column to be at this meeting. There, for the first time, these key figures in the Army of Northern Virginia would gather there at the Dabbs House to determine how to save the Confederate capital of Richmond. It's a moment that sparks imagination. Here they all are. They would come up with a plan, or they would listen to Lee's plan, come up with the time schedule. Jackson would then ride back, once again, about 13 hours, to his command. The plan was to launch the attack on June 26. However, on June 25th, at a place known as Oak Grove, the Federals attacked. You see, what Lee wanted to do is leave about a third of his army in front of the Confederate capital of Richmond, take the other two-thirds as a strike force, and in that surprise move, bring General Stonewall Jackson down from the Shenandoah Valley to outflank the Federal position there north of the Chickahominy. But the area where he was pulling the troops from is the area that the Federals were now attacking. So on June 25th, he had to wonder, do they know what I'm about to do? Has my plan been tipped off? Finally, he determines that Oak Grove is just a small, minor offensive. He will go ahead with his plan. The attack will begin the very next day. Now, on June 26th, the attack should begin in the morning. Longstreet and D.H. Hill's divisions are strung back along the Mechanicsville Turnpike. There, the high ground hides them from Federal view. Mechanicsville is just on the other side of the Chickahominy River where the Federals are. General A.P. Hill's division is about 2 miles north of them at a place known as Meadow Bridge. And about 6 more miles to the north of that is one of Hill's brigades under Branch at a place called Half Sink. What Lee is hoping to do for this attack is going to be one of the most complicated and difficult things that you can do, is have many converging columns arrive on the battlefield at the same time at the right place. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. And one of the main problems is going to be Stonewall Jackson. Throughout the 7 days, if there is a Confederate general who's not where he's supposed to be, who's having difficulty, it's Stonewall Jackson. People will say that there's the Jackson of the Valley and the Jackson of the Chickahominy, and they are not the same. After this, he will go back to the Jackson of the Valley, do incredible things, but throughout the 7 days, his performance is poor. He is late. And remember, he was the one to outflank that strong position. He is the one to start everything for the saving of Richmond. The hours begin to pass on June 26, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Oh, and by the way, he sends no word that he's running late. A.P. Hill does not communicate. Lee is there along Mechanicsville Turnpike, Chickahominy Bluff area, looking towards Mechanicsville, waiting to see something happen. Nothing is happening. 1 o'clock passes. You can probably imagine the only thing that could be worse is to have your boss there. And of course, who shows up? Well, let's let an officer by the name of Brent tell us. He was on Magruder's staff. He would write, "When I left General Lee's side, I gave attention to the remarkable scene which was before me. Longstreet, D.H. Hill, the division commanders, and a few brigade officers were standing on the road on the side of which I entered. Long columns of infantry hidden from observation, and the heat extended parallel to the road until lost into the woods. 50 yards back, on the opposite side of the road, sitting in the shade of a few trees, were several dismounted persons. Amongst them, I saw President Jefferson Davis and Mr. Randolph, the Secretary of War. And further to the front were a few gentlemen of General Lee's staff. No one seemed to be talking to his neighbor, and over all there seemed to rest a cloud of painful anxiety. I had never in my life seen more gloomy faces than those of the President and Secretary Randolph. General Lee was an exception to the rest of us, and he preserved externally that magnificent balance which was his characteristic. But I had seen him too often not to discover the serenity of his countenance was only a mask to disguise the tremendous strain upon him. His eyes were restless with the look of a man with fever. I had never seen him otherwise than exhibiting a neatness and correctness of attire. But on this occasion, upon the surface, were apparent unusual appearances. His necktie or cravat had slipped around until the bow rested under his ear, and one leg of his trousers was noticeably displaced. So Lee was a little bit anxious, nervous, not knowing what's going on. But about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, General A.P. Hill, who is 2 miles to the north, feeling that Jackson must surely be close now on his own initiative without hearing from Jackson, without touching base with Lee, crosses the Meadow Bridge, pushes the Federals back, clears down through Mechanicsville, pushes the Federals away, and heads towards their strong defensive position at Beaver Dam Creek. Lee, seeing the Confederate troops in Mechanicsville, goes, ah, those are Hill's men. He rides over, and it's at this time he finds out Jackson's not on the scene. Hill's crossed on his own initiative. His hand has been shown. What does he do now? He cannot fall back. He needs to continue the assault. He needs to keep the pressure. So now, doing exactly what he did not want to do, he attacks the Federal position in frontal assaults. Jackson was supposed to outflank that strong ground, but Jackson's not there. A.P. Hill's men launch his attacks against the ground. Later, Jackson's troops do arrive. They get in to within a few miles of the northernmost of Hill's units. Being in an unfamiliar area, feeling that Jackson is where he's supposed to be, he puts his men to bivouac, hearing the battle going on in the distance. The first battle for Robert E. Lee is a stinging defeat. It will suffer on the Confederate side, mostly Hill's troops. There's also some of Ripley's brigade from D.H. Hill's division as well. 1,400 casualties. Federals probably between 300 and 400. Very lopsided. But that night, McClellan will find out that Jackson is on his flank. And although he did not attack, Lee's strategy is still working. Because now McClellan orders the 5th Corps, which had been defending there at Beaver Dam Creek, that part of the Federal Army on the north side is the 5th Corps under General Fitz John Porter. He orders them to retreat. He had to, because through maneuver, Lee's plan was still working. Federal soldiers, though, didn't realize this. They were just told to retreat after they won a battle. And this frustrated them greatly. Why are we retreating? Why are we falling back? But they did. Through the night, they fell back about 4 miles to another strong position behind a little creek called Boatswain's Creek, near a mill known as Gaines's Mill. There they would make a strong defensive position. The next day, Lee will pursue. And Lee looks at his map and he decides that if I were the Federal commander, I would make my line behind Powhite Creek, another creek just about a mile or so to the north, to the west of Boatswain's Creek. Powhite Creek is where Gaines Mill actually sits. That's where Lee assumes the Federals are going to be. For his map, in that area, it only has Powhite Creek, and then where Boatswain's Creek is supposed to be is a big blank spot, and it says Turkey Hill. So Lee didn't even know that that creek was there. He didn't know the strength of that position, and so he plans accordingly. When the Confederate troops initially hit Powhite Creek, there are a few Federal defenders there. They quickly fall back. A.P. Hill's men quickly pursue after them. They fall all the way back to Boatswain's Creek, and then all of a sudden, A.P. Hill's men find the 5th Corps when a tremendous fire pours out. And now the battle begins to rage in the afternoon of June 27th, the battle that would become the largest and costliest battle of the 7 days, Gaines's Mill. Initially, it would be piecemeal assaults that would be made by the Confederates. As more and more units come up, arrive on the field, and thrown into the action, and each time they're beaten back. But then, like the ocean waves coming forward, they will push forward again and then fall back. Then more troops come in and push forward and fall back. Once again, Jackson is late. This time, he's actually been given a guide. He had met up with Lee earlier in the day. They had issued Jackson a guide, a cavalryman by the name of Timberlake, who's from the area. Jackson told him, take me to Cold Harbor. And so the guide did. But he took him by a shortcut. A shortcut that as they took the shortcut, Jackson began to hear firing coming from his front. And he asked the guide, well, where is that firing coming from? And he says, it's coming from Gaines Mill. And Jackson will tell him, no, I wish to arrive at Cold Harbor, leaving Gaines Mill well to my right. And the guide won't tell him. If you had told me that in the first place, we would have taken the road back there. So now Jackson will turn his column around once again, assuring they will be late. Eventually, his troops do arrive on the battlefield late in the day. Lee and Jackson would meet up along the Cold Harbor Road, and Lee will say to Jackson, ah, General Jackson, it is good to see you. I'd hoped to meet with you earlier. Maybe a gentle criticism there? Finally, late in the day, Lee will be able to amass his soldiers for what will be the largest assault, series of assaults he'll make throughout the course of the war. The vast majority of those Confederate soldiers, keep in mind he probably has about 50 to 55,000 men on the north side of the Chickahominy. The rest of his army is on the south side. Also keep in mind that his total strength is probably about 93,000 men. This will be the largest Confederate army ever put in the field outside of Richmond. You always think of the two armies being so opposite in numbers. This is one battle where they're pretty close. And here at Gaines Mill, he actually outnumbers the Federals because he's only attacking a portion. 28,000 members of the 5th Corps. Eventually, they bump up to about 35,000. They're reinforced by Slocum's division. But these men have been fighting throughout the day. They're exhausted. They're tired. And late in the day, Lee does launch this all-out assault. It's not picture perfect, but he gets all the men moving. They will eventually be able to break the Federal lines there at Gaines' Mill, giving Lee his first victory as commander of the Army of Northern Virginia. The soldiers who have traditionally gotten the credit for it were members of the Texas Brigade. John Bell Hood, leading the 4th Texas himself, he commanded the regiment initially, and he had always promised he would lead them in their first major action, and this would be that action. They would break through the lines. The Federals would begin to retreat towards the Chickahominy River. Their position there at Gaines' Mill was in the shape of a crescent because it was guarding the bridges of the Chickahominy, those military bridges that connected the 5th Corps of the Federal Army with the rest of the Union Army on the south side. So you can see why they were defending that ground so hard. That was their lifeline. The Federals retreat towards the Chickahominy River, towards those bridges. Two reinforcement brigades come up, French's brigade, Marr's brigade. They are able to hold the Confederates back as darkness sets in. But here, Lee had achieved his first victory. This was the battle that many Confederate soldiers said gave them confidence in their new commander. So at Gaines' Mill, in one day, you have about 15,000 casualties. You had the largest assault that Lee would make throughout the course of the war, giving him his first victory as commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, and his troops beginning to get confidence in their new commander. Following this action, General McClellan has to make a decision. What am I going to do now? He decides he's going to have to abandon White House Landing, and he's going to have to head elsewhere. He decides the James River. That's where he's going to go. He will refer to it as a change of base, but others will call it a retreat. And now Lee has to figure out what he's doing as well. Is he going to fall back down the peninsula to the east? Is he going to head towards the James River? Where is he going to go? June 28th is sort of the eye of the storm where Lee is trying to figure out just that. Finally, by June 29th, he knows that McClellan is heading down towards the James River. But keep in mind, as he's doing that, he is literally marching in front of that one-third of the Confederate Army defending Richmond. That one-third under General Magruder and General Huger. Now he's going to order those soldiers to move out, engage, slow down that column, because it is not enough for Lee to push the Federal Army away. He's relieved the semi-siege of Richmond. But now is his opportunity to destroy that threat. If you push it away, it's just going to come back. Now you can destroy it, and that is what he is trying to do. But Magruder will not perform well on this particular day. He will engage the Federal Army at Allen's Farm, and because he engaged them so quickly and because they were supposed to be retreating and they didn't seem to be, he begins to get cautious. The Federals then fall back to a position at Savage's Station. Magruder tentatively pushes forward. He's told he'll be sent reinforcements by General Huger, as well as General Jackson should join him. So he decides to wait. But as he waits too long, because Huger had been told if your troops are not used by a certain time, you can call them back. That time arrived, and Huger called them back. General Jackson would report that he had other important duty to perform. So he's not going to come. So then Magruder will push out himself and make piecemeal assaults. Once again, the Federal Army is able to continue its retreat. Once again, Lee is frustrated. While Magruder was doing that, Lee was sending Longstreet's division, A.P. Hill's division, back into Richmond so that they could then head out the Charles City and Darbytown roads, head out those roads heading east to try and cut the Federals off from the James. He's hoping Magruder will buy them the time, but he's not. Following day, June the 30th, 1862, is going to be one of the best opportunities throughout the course of the war for the Confederates to do significant damage to the Federal Army. Through maneuver, Lee is going to have his army attacking along several different fronts at a choke point at a place known it's Glendale Crossroads. There at Glendale, the Federal Army is going through a little choke point. And what Lee will have happen is he will have Confederate troops coming along the Charles City Road, Darbytown Road to Longbridge, along the New Market Road, and Jackson following directly behind them. He should be able to crush a part of the Federal Army. But once again, things don't go as he had hoped. General Huger is supposed to launch this assault along the Charles City Road because he has the shortest route to take. However, he is so sure that he's about to be attacked at any time that he does this very tentatively. The Federals begin to chop trees down along the Charles City Road to slow him down. And rather than send troops ahead to clear them away, one of his officers, a man by the name of Billy Mahone, an engineer, says, you know what we should do? We should make a road right alongside. And so it becomes a battle of axemen as people are cutting down trees to block them and others are cutting down trees to make a new road. Huger will finally get close enough to engage in artillery fire, but that's about it. One division out of action for Lee. Then he will have General Holmes along the New Market Road. He will say that he sees Federal troops retreating down Malvern Hill. Well, Lee will head down there as well, and eventually he will decide, you know what? I'm going to send General Magruder and his command down to support you. So Magruder's reserve is now marching away. That's okay because I've got all these other troops that are here. Well, now you have Jackson's command at White Oak Swamp. And initially Jackson shows great initiative. The Federals are on the other side of White Oak Swamp, blocking it, slowing him down. So he brings up his artillery, he has them loaded, and then they come up to the crest of a hill, they turn around, they open fire, the Federals scatter, elements of the 2nd Virginia Cavalry cross the creek, Jackson himself goes across, and then they realize that there's a lot of Federals in the wood line just on the other side as well. And now they quickly rush on back. Now Jackson falls into a lethargic spell. Colonel Mumford of the 2nd Virginia will say, we found a place where you can ford. That's how we got back across to the north side. It's on the flank of the Federals. You could go there. Jackson ignores it. General Hampton will come to him and say, we found a place where we can build a bridge. Jackson tells him, do it. He does do it. He comes back at a later time. He tells Jackson that the bridge is complete. Jackson kind of stares at him, stands up, and walks away without saying a word. That night, Jackson will fall asleep at the table with a biscuit between his teeth, according to Dabney, then kind of shake himself awake and say, gentlemen, to bed, and tomorrow let's see if we cannot do something. His entire command is out of action. Once again, it will be Longstreet and AP Hill's divisions. They'll be bearing the brunt of the attack, and they will attack. So this great opportunity for the Confederates is now slipping away. And in the fighting that takes place, there will be some of the most savage hand-to-hand fighting as they fight for possession of artillery along Long Ridge Road. Federal guns defending their position. And the poor unit that is there suffering the brunt of the assault is the Pennsylvania Reserves on the federal side of the 5th Corps. They're the ones who fought at Beaver Dam Creek. They're the ones who fought at Gaines' Mill. They're the ones who fought in so many of these actions that are fought out. And then because of poor placement of their troops, they receive the brunt of the fighting once again. Eventually, General McCall himself will be captured in that action. By the end of the day, it's basically a draw. But the Federal Army is able to continue its retreat till finally they are in a very strong defensive position there at Malvern Hill on July 1st. There they will create a position along a ridge that's about 875 yards wide. They will have about 29 to 36 pieces of artillery, with more artillery heading to the rear and gunboats behind them in the James River. Yes, now they can receive assistance from the gunboats. One Confederate officer will go to General Lee and say, you know, if McClellan is there in strength, I think it's best we leave him alone. But others, such as James Longstreet, would say, let's not get scared now that we've got him on the run. One more good push and they will break. And Lee was inclined to think that way as well. He wanted one more chance to strike. He wanted to destroy that threat. So he came up with a plan to neutralize this strong position. They would try to establish their own artillery on opposite ends of the Confederate line, create a crossfire that would neutralize the Federal artillery, and that would allow the infantry to push forward. However, the orders that were written for this were poorly done. They would read, batteries have been established to rake the enemy's lines. If they are broken, as is probable, Armistead, who is closest, can witness the effect of the fire, has been ordered to charge with a yell. Do the same. Well, these are very strange orders for a number of reasons. One, it basically gives command of the entire action to General Armistead, a mere brigade commander in one of his first major battles. He's going to make the decision to go or no go. Two, it said batteries had been established. They hadn't been. They were going to try to. However, the moment they became visible to the Union artillery, which was already there, they became targets and were destroyed or neutralized fairly quickly. Yes, they were able to lob some shells over, but they were not able to be as effective as Lee had hoped. Finally, the signal to launch the attack is one brigade, Armistead's, charging with yell. All the noise and confusion on the battlefield, that was going to signal the attack for everybody. And then finally, I should say, there was also no time written on those orders, and that would play a critical part. At a certain point, Lee realizes that his plan's not going to work, but he never cancels those orders. They're still out there. They're still floating. Then events begin to happen on the battlefield. You see, General Magruder has spent much of the morning actually accidentally marching away from the battlefield because of confusion. Finally, he has turned around. He comes back to Malvern Hill, and when he does, he sees some of the Confederate infantry pushing forward, some of Armistead's men. They were pushing forward not to begin an engagement, but because they had been harassed by Berdan sharpshooters, and they were tired of it, so they pushed forward to drive them away. Well, Magruder arrives on the field. He sends a note to Lee saying, I've arrived, and Armistead has advanced. This works its way off to Lee. Also, Lee gets word that the Federals may be retreating. They are falling back from Malvern Hill. They weren't retreating. Basically, the Confederate artillery did get some shot and shell going. There was all that infantry. They didn't want to sit out under artillery fire if they didn't have to, so they just fell back to the other side of the hill so they'd be protected. But to the Confederates, it looked like they were retreating. So now Lee gets word, Federals may be retreating, Armistead has advanced. So what does he do to, what order does he send to Magruder? Support Armistead. Then later in the day, those orders that Lee had sent out earlier They never found Magruder because he was marching away from the battlefield. There's no time written on them, so Magruder thinks they're current. Batteries have been established to rake the enemy's lines. Armistead will charge with the yell. Do the same. He thinks this is a current order. He gets another one saying, support Armistead. Now, because of confusion, Confederate infantry begins to pour towards the federal position. Union artillery now turns its attention to that infantry and fires solid shot and shell and case shot and that shotgun-like blast of canister. If the Confederates get close enough, infantry, Union infantry will push forward and drive them away. By the end of the day, the Confederates will suffer over 5,000 casualties. Federals, surprisingly, will suffer over 3,000. It's closer than you would think. And there was more infantry fighting than you're led to believe. Most people think it's just artillery against infantry, but it was not. Fitzjohn Porter would actually destroy his diary, I believe, thinking that the battle was hanging in the balance, but the Federals did hold. Interestingly, the majority of the battles of the 7 days are Confederate defeats, except for Gaines' Mill. But the 7 days as a whole is an overwhelming Confederate victory, because with each Federal victory, they use to retreat away from Richmond. Finally, by July 2nd, Federal Army is on its way towards Harrison's Landing, its new supply base on the James River. There the Army will be concentrated. There the Army will have the protection of the United States Navy. There the Union Army will be safe. But on July 2nd, this Federal cavalryman by the name of Averill looked across the ground early on the morning. This is what he saw. Our ears had been filled with agonizing cries from thousands before the fog lifted on July 2nd. But now our eyes saw an appalling spectacle upon the slopes down to the woodlands half a mile away. Over 5,000 dead and wounded men were on the ground in every attitude of distress. A third were dead or dying, but enough were alive and moving to give the field a singular crawling effect. Federal Army reaches the safety of Harrison's Landing. Lee has accomplished one of his goals. He has saved the Confederate capital in the summer of 1862. But he is unable to accomplish that other goal of destroying the Federal Army, and it continues to be a threat. This is truly a major turning point in the war. Following this, Lee would seize the initiative and take the war into Northern Virginia, returning to Manassas, achieving another victory and invading the North for the first time. Many people now began to see the South as winning the war. Frustrated Lincoln to no end because they still had all the success in the Western theater. None of that had gone away. But following the 7 days, many people thought the South may be winning. For right or wrong, they looked to the East for how the war was going. This was the beginning of a series of victories that Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia would enjoy throughout 1862 and 1863, truly changing the momentum of the war in the East. On the northern side, Lincoln began to realize that the war was going to have to be fought differently and for different purposes. Within a month's time of the 7 days' battles, Lincoln will put out a call for 300,000 more troops. He will sign the Second Confiscation Act, which allows for the confiscation of even slaves, and he will have a preliminary draft of the Emancipation Proclamation in his hands. From this point forward, Lincoln realizes the war is going to have to be fought differently, for different purposes. It is not going to be the war to restore the old Union. The South is not rising up to rally around the flag like he had been told. His best army has now just been pushed away, and it's going to have to be done a different way. Those battles fought outside Richmond, in which 35,000 casualties took place. Think of how that staggered the country, north and south. From the time of First Manassas, the number of casualties suffered, to the time of Shiloh, with about 25, 26,000 casualties, to now the 7 days with 35,000 casualties, it shocked the country. And Lincoln realized the war was going to be different. It is truly a changing point in the American Civil War and also a changing point in this country's history. And that is why I feel those 7 days' battles in the Peninsula Campaign deserve attention, because they are such an important part of the story. And I'd like to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to come here this evening and tell you a little bit about it. Thank you so much. Are there any questions? Just one in the back there?
Yes, a couple. The names of Stonewall Jackson.
Yes, Stonewall Jackson.
Do you have any insight, having done obviously a tremendous amount of research on this, as to why do you think Jackson did not really perform that well during this action? And my other specific question is, why did it take him so long to get from Fort Republic into the action?
All right, the two-parter question is, first, why Jackson's performance was subpar during the 7 days. And I will tell you that that is something that historians have feasted on for years and years and continue to, is analyzing it. And probably the best answer I could give you, and they have had many possibilities, but I think is he is exhausted. As I mentioned, he rode ahead. First of all, he just finished his remarkable Valley campaign. He is now transporting his army towards Richmond. He rode ahead through the night to have the meeting at the Dabbs house, had the meeting, and then rode back through another night to join his command. And to answer part of your second part, that command now was all strung out while he was gone, and it would take him a while to get them back under control and going forward, and he would not be able to make the same type of marches that he had done in the Valley. And so he is not going to cover the same type of ground. Yes, he does have the train network that is also ferrying troops towards Richmond, but his men are not able to do the same type of marches because they're not the same type of roads. It's a much different area they're not as familiar with. He did not have Hotchkiss, his great map maker, who was able to tell him, this is how you get there, this is how you do this, this is, you know, how long it'll take. So there were a lot of factors, I think, that fed into it, but I think the biggest one of all was he just pushed himself as much as he pushed his army and was exhausted. And I know when I'm pretty tired, I can't do things as well as when I'm not. And I think that is probably the most likely reason. Yes? Yes, the Battle of Oak Grove.
That's about where Byrd Airport is now, right?
Yes, and I love hearing it still referred to as Byrd Airport. It is now Richmond International Airport, but I still refer to it as Byrd Airport. And that's exactly where it is. The same area as Seven Pines, basically. In that vicinity, much of that area has been pretty well developed because of the airport. Interestingly enough, to get 7 days of battles, you include Oak Grove, June 25th to July 1st. Many historians, though, are not now covering or counting Oak Grove as one of the 7 days, primarily because it was initiated by the Federals. It was a small engagement, and the true story of the 7 days is Lee's drive to push the Federals away. And that story begins on June 26th, not on June 25th. So many historians now go from June 26th to July 2nd when the Federal Army retreats to Harrison's Landing. So Oak Grove, in many accounts, is kind of disappearing from the 7 days.
When they characterize, remember, Joe Johnson is the one now in charge of this defense of Richmond.
Right.
And the whole thing. And he was the ranking officer that went to the Confederacy from the old Union.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of saw this, he was the man. Later on, they say, well, yes, the most precipitous shot was the one that injured me.
Yep, the artilleryman, yeah.
But the point was is that there was always a little bit of an animosity or a little kind of a, you know, he wasn't too keen on the idea, but yet the characterization, the change. What did Joe Johnson have in mind for a success on this compared to what Lee ended up doing?
Yes, what Lee wanted to do is attack the Federals as far away from Richmond as possible. Johnston wanted to pull closer to Richmond, closer to his resources and things like that. Johnston also had difficulty with the president because of what you described. He felt he should have been made a higher rank above Lee, but he was not. He was put below Lee, primarily because the position he was in was a position where you assume, you know, like quartermaster general or commissary general. And Jefferson Davis did not view that. He said, no, your true rank is, you know, lieutenant colonel or current, whatever it may be.
There was animosity, too, back correct. In the old days when he was Secretary of War, right? Davis and Johnson was...
But it was a girl in the beginning when they were young people, weren't they? Didn't they fight over a girl?
Now, that I don't know so much about any girl. Now, A.P. Hill and McClellan, they both went after the same girl, and she married McClellan. And one of the things is A.P. Hill seemed to always attack McClellan very aggressively, and some of the troops were like, Ellen, why didn't you marry A.P. Hill? Something to that effect. Anyway, but there was also some grumblings over, I think, some of the reports from Manassas and things like that. So, yes, there was not a good relationship between Jefferson Davis and Joe Johnston. Mm-hmm. Johnston often kept things secretive from Jefferson Davis, very much like McClellan did with Lincoln. But Davis was not the type of personality that Lincoln was, and he would hold a grudge. And where those type of things, Lincoln would kind of, if you'll give me victories, I'll put up with the, you know, with the snubs and the other type of problems that you cause. Davis never would. He was not that type of man.
Physical creeks of rain, things mm-hmm. along those lines, the swamps, did that cause troops' movements to be like funneled into areas where they could cross and possibly cause one of some of these battles to change?
Correct. The question is about asking about the rain and the waterways and if those affected where the battles were fought. And yes, they definitely did. The Chickahominy River, under normal conditions, is insignificant, but it has a very wide floodplain. And if it rains, as it did in the summer of 1862, that floodplain in some areas can be as much as a mile. And all of a sudden, that insignificant river becomes a major obstacle. And that river would play such an important part in that campaign, in the thinking of Joe Johnston when he attacks, in the thinking of Robert E. Lee when he attacks. The Chickahominy, if you're going to get at Richmond, you have to cross over. If you're going to use White House Landing as your supply line, you got to have troops on that side as well. Yeah. You're going to have to cut your army in two. So it is going to play, and the rain and the difficulty of negotiating it and those bridges are critical. And that's why Gaines Mills fought where it is because the Federals wanted to protect that those bridges that were their lifeline. Yes.
What do you think about the impact of absolutely poor quality of maps that Lee's army had? In fact, I've read that some of the best maps that he did have were prepared by the French in 1781, Siege of Yorktown. And for example, Longstreet, missed, I think in one case he mistook the old Quaker Road from another Quaker Road,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that it's hard for me to believe that this far into the war, they did not have anything like the topo engineers.
As the Federals approached Richmond, they were busy mapping the ground very well. So you can make a case that the Federals had better maps outside of Richmond than the Confederates did. I think one of the keys to Jackson's success in the Valley, as I mentioned, was Hotchkiss and his ability to make maps and his ability to work with Jackson and tell him the shortest points. And once again, Hotchkiss is left behind in the Valley to continue working on maps and such. So maps are critical. It is just something that they failed to do to an adequate degree on the Confederate side. And as I mentioned, the biggest impact, and you can see the map in the 4-volume set of Lee by Freeman. There's a copy of it. For Gaines Mill, there's for that battlefield, Bosun's Creek's not shown, and it's just a big blank spot with Turkey Hill written. So there's a case where Lee didn't even know that, you know, that defensive position was there. And the engineers did a poor job. Yes?
Did McClellan ever think of using the tactics that Grant, as far as attacking Richmond from the south?
He would make a case later on that he had always intended to use the James River as his primary base of operations and so forth. But when you read the accounts at the time, it seems more and more when you read it that he always intended for White House to be his primary base, primarily because of the railroad and being able to use that to bring supplies on up towards the front lines and for all the heavy artillery. But yes, years later, he will make a case that that had been something he had considered and wanted to do, if I remember correctly.
A lot of us haven't been down to these battlefields before, so can you give us a sense of what's preserved and how the current situation is?
It's an exciting time. Like I say, not only are we coming up on the sesquicentennial for the 7 days, which will be starting here shortly, but around Richmond, we have pieces of those battlefields, and they're getting larger, those pieces, which we're very fortunate. Beaver Dam Creek or Mechanicsville is just a small little piece, but when you get to Gaines Mill, we've had about 60 acres for the longest time. The Civil War Trust is now in the process of preserving about 200 acres covering Longstreet's attack route and the place where they feel the federal balloons went up prior to the 7 days to take a look at what the Confederate defenses are. So they are in the process of saving that. As you continue farther on down, Savage's Station is right where 295 and 64 comes together. So there's no way that land can be preserved. It's already pretty much been destroyed by that. But the real estate cost alone would be too much for any preservation. But as you get down to Glendale and Malvern Hill, Malvern Hill has always been our best preserved battlefield, where we have about 90% of it preserved. It's in great shape, and we're still turning much of that land into a park. Glendale, much of that has just been preserved by the Civil War Trust, and just a few months ago, they had a check signing type program where they were able to pay off most of that Glendale land, and that should be coming over to the park very, very soon, and we will start the process of turning that into a park. So pretty soon, you'll be able to walk from Longbridge Road all the way down to the guns of Malvern Hill and even farther south and stay on park property. It'll be amazing, yeah. So it's very exciting. So groups like the Civil War Trust and the Richmond Battlefields Association, which is a local group, and also Virginia Antiquities for Preservation, they've also done quite a bit. So we've been very lucky with the work that our preservation groups have done for us. Yeah, one in the back there.
So in the 7 days war, mm-hmm. if you have to choose one general from the Confederate side, in addition to Robert Lee, which one you would use? Who performs best?
The one who really performs quite well, I think, on the Confederate side, the one who seems the most aggressive and to be would either be General A.P. Hill, who does very well and as a division commander excels, is arguably the finest division commander in the Confederate Army. When he gets beyond that, then you start to have problems. But as a division commander, he is outstanding. Longstreet is also the other one that Lee puts a lot of faith in and trust in. So both Longstreet and A.P. Hill will do well during the 7 days, where Jackson will not. As well as Magruder and Huger and Holmes. Jackson wasn't the only one.
Well, thank you so much.